California Public Radio presents Vietnam Reconsidered, Lessons from a War. On February 6th through 9th, 1983, just 10 years after the signing of the Paris Peace Accords, the University of Southern California hosted a conference re-examining the Vietnam War. For 4 days, over 60 panelists and 1,000 participants reviewed and sometimes replayed the war in Vietnam. In this series of programs, California Public Radio will bring you the views of correspondents, former government officials, and scholars, as well as the voices of Vietnamese refugees and Vietnam vets, as they reconsider the war that transformed them and their countries, as they reconsider Vietnam. Part 2, The Press Goes to War, The War Comes Home.
Come, let's move in with those other guys.
This is what the war in Vietnam is all about. The old and the very young. The Marines have burned this old couple's cottage because fire was coming from here. And now when you walk into the village, you see no young people at all. Fire was coming from light automatic weapons fire was coming from all of these villages. It's not really one village, it's a string of huts.
Been in action like this before, Marie?
No, I haven't. Not like this, I haven't.
Did you set fire to these houses here?
No, we were just off to the left of it when it was burning.
Were you getting fire from them?
Somewhat, not too much, just a little sniper fire.
It first appeared that the Marines had been sniped at and that a few houses were made to pay. Shortly after, an officer told me he had orders to go in and level the string of hamlets that surrounds Cam Ne Village. And all around the common paddy field that feeds these hamlets, a ring of fire. 150 homes were leveled in retaliation for a burst of gunfire. If there were Viet Cong in the hamlets, they were long gone. Alerted by the roar of the amphibious tractors and the heavy barrage of rocket fire laid down before the troops moved in. The women and the old men who remained will never forget that August afternoon.
Morley Safer, co-editor of the CBS program 60 Minutes, reported from Vietnam for CBS in 1965. This story on the burning of Cam Ne Village was one of the first controversial television reports on the war. Mr. Safer joined journalists David Halberstam, Peter Arnett, John Lawrence, and others in a series of panel discussions on the quality of reporting during the war.
Philip Knightley called his book on war coverage The First Casualty. The title comes from a statement by Senator Hiram Johnson, who in 1917 said that in war, truth is the first casualty. It was said again not long after the night of Tuesday, August 4th, 1964, the night of the Tonkin Gulf incident. It was said by U Thant. He said, "I'm sure that the great American people, if they only know the facts and the background to the developments in South Vietnam, will agree with me that further bloodshed is unnecessary, and also that the political and diplomatic method of discussion and negotiation alone can create conditions which will enable the United States to withdraw gracefully from that part of the world. As you know, in times of war and hostilities, the first casualty is truth." If indeed the truth is the first to die, the question in the Vietnam War is who killed it. The title for this session is The Quality of Reporting, a subject I approach with some reluctance. Assessing quality is not really a reporter's function. It's for editors and journalism reviews and historians who carry no Vietnam baggage. I agreed to take part in this conference because there is a not too subtle move afoot to rewrite history and to assign the blame to the messengers of that war, to justify the official lies of Vietnam. If the truth was the first casualty in Vietnam, it is a corpse that will not stay dead. There are those who would now try to drive a stake through its heart. Robert Elegant, Philip mentioned, formerly of Newsweek and lately a successful writer of fiction, wrote in Encounter a year and a half ago that the war was won by the combined American-South Vietnamese forces but was lost because of political pressures built up by the media that prevented Washington giving further support to the Saigon government. He goes further and states that press and broadcasting helped one way or another to bring tens of millions of people under grinding totalitarian rule, and that because our responsibility in tilting the global balance of power is too great to acknowledge, we absolve ourselves by blaming exclusively Johnson, Nixon, and Kissinger. So Mr. Elegant accuses us of not only losing Vietnam, but the Cold War as well. And maybe Jimmy Hoffa and Judge Crater, too. Our purpose in all this, he says, was for the praise of our fellows, that we were members of a club out there, and the club wrote, and it spoke with one voice. The Encounter piece is 17 vituperative pages long. It claims to quote correspondents who, since the war, have come to Mr. Elegant confessing their sins, knew they were spreading lies, disillusion, and disinformation, but the devil of ambition and approval by colleagues made them do it. He offers, of course, no names. He saves his big artillery for television. He offers a, quote, hard documented instance. And I quote exactly. A burning village was news even though it was a deserted village used in a Marine training exercise, even though the television correspondent handed his Zippo lighter to a non-commissioned officer with the suggestion that he set fire to an abandoned house, unquote. That is hard, documented instance. No date, no village, no network name, no correspondent name, no Marine unit name. Hard, documented evidence. I recommend the Elegant piece to you as a primer in journalism, Soviet style. Meadax the critics of a policy by questioning their patriotism, by accusing them of being in the thrall of petty bourgeois ambition. Generate enough smoke and hope that no one examines the piece closely enough to notice that there are no facts, only scapegoats.
The author of the critical article Safer mentioned was not at the conference, but another critic of the media was. Major General Winant Seidel served as chief of information for General William Westmoreland from 1967 to 1969. General Seidel addresses the issue of how well members of the press corps were prepared for their assignments in Vietnam.
The American Society of Newspaper Editors did a survey of the reporting from Vietnam, which they announced in about the middle of 68. And they studied both what we in the government were telling the press and what the press were saying about Vietnam. And we both, neither of us did too well. But here I'm not here to talk about how poorly we did on the government side. That's been addressed many times. But one thing the ASNE study did, it characterized the quality of the press corps in Vietnam, the quality of the press corps, and hence the reporting, as not sufficiently professional. They gave three reasons for this. Too many inexpert freelancers and stringers. And believe me, I can tell you that's true. I was in charge in the 2 years I was there of accrediting reporters, and all we had to have a document signed by someone we thought was a publisher or an editor saying that this gentleman or lady is going to write stuff and are going to put it on radio tape or whatever, and we're going to look at it. We may not use it, we're going to look at it. That's all it took. We had some very interesting people come through. One turned out to be a barber. One turned out to be a guitar player. Several turned out to be real estate men trying to sell real estate in Florida. They had a phony letterhead, and fortunately, we would send these back to the Pentagon and they'd check them out. But I don't know how much real estate these three guys sold, but they were there about a month before we caught them. So that was one problem. Second reason, they said, too many short tours. That's already been touched upon here. There's no time to learn what's really going on in 6 months. In fact, a war, a year is pretty tough. To cover this complicated war, as several people have said, required insight and a depth of experience and professional knowledge. And you couldn't learn that in 6 months. So that was a problem. The other reason that the ASNE raised was too many reporters were going to Vietnam trying to make names for themselves. And that's perfectly logical. I'm sure that would be true in any war. But they said too many. Now those are three pretty good reasons. for the quality of the reporting being impaired somewhat, I have six more I'd like to run by you quickly. I would say there were too many reporters. Now, we're talking after Tet, remember. March 31st, 1968, I had accredited 649 reporters in Vietnam. That's a lot. And as several people have also said, they have to get out of Saigon to cover the war. Most of them didn't. There was a good, solid, hardcore of guys that went out of Saigon all the time. But most of those people, we estimated at one time over 500 of that 649 never left Saigon. That's not very good for reporting. Now, in addition to the inexperienced freelancers and stringers, there were some pretty inexperienced reporters, full-time, that were assigned by major media. I won't bore you with a lot of examples, but I'll give you one, which I think was the worst one. We had a little system in Saigon. When a new reporter arrived, our people in public affairs would brief them, try to bring them up to date so they could get off to some kind of a start. And then after this briefing, which took all morning, I would talk with them for a few minutes to see if they had any questions or if they hadn't understood something or something. This one guy, he was assigned for a major U.S. newspaper, their sole man in Vietnam, but there permanently, I mean indefinitely. The first question he asked me, he said, "General, I heard all these briefings and things, but I didn't understand several things. Would you mind telling me what a battalion is?" Now, I don't know how many of you have been in the military, but that's a pretty basic question for a guy being sent over to report on a war. He went from bad to worse. A year later, he got the sack by his paper because his reporting just wasn't cutting it. But think of his poor readers. Maybe some of you were included, who was reading this stuff by this fellow that didn't know what a battalion was. I'm sorry to say they sent him home, but another equally big newspaper hired him and sent him back in about 2 months. He only lasted 6 months that time. Now, I'm not saying all the reporters were like that, but we had too many of them, to suit me anyway. Another basic thing a lot of reporters didn't do after Tet, particularly, when we started getting more younger and more inexperienced reporters, they were unwilling to check stories out. We've heard comments here about how the government had a tough time telling the truth and so forth. But that doesn't solve the problem of checking out a story. Whether we would give a story to a newsman or whether he'd get it from an outside source, if he's a good newsman, he's got to check it out. As a result of this laziness, perhaps, or a distrust of us, you can't tell why they didn't check them out. There are a lot of stories that got out on the wires and elsewhere. I don't mean the wires, AP and UPI, but got sent back to the States for publication that just weren't true or were grossly exaggerated, all because of no checking.
Peter Arnett, correspondent for the Associated Press in Vietnam from 1962 to 1970, was one of the best-known combat reporters during the war. He followed General Seidel to the podium.
I am tempted to throw out my prepared remarks and answer Mr. Seidel, but I spent a lot of time with my prepared remarks. I'll simply point out, in relation to all these inexperienced reporters, the Associated Press provided information for approximately 1,600 American newspapers, most of which did not send reporters to Vietnam. I want to mention these names in the AP: George Esper, Rick Marin, Horst Fass, Ed White, John Wheeler, Henry Hewitt, myself, each a total of 9 years in Vietnam. That adds up 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8. That's about 65 years. I don't know what Mr. Seidel would want in experience, but I think with our 65 years, we did endeavor to learn maybe where the provinces were at least. And as far as being concerned about the freelancers, it was Lyndon Johnson who tried to kick me out of Vietnam in 1968 and not all these long-haired freelancers, which Mr. Seidel is so interested in. Last night, and I'm not counting me, but you tar us all with that rather wide brush, and I resent it, but I expect it.
The night before this exchange, Mr. Arnett had read a combat dispatch he wrote in 1969.
This dispatch was written on August 25 of 69, and it referred to another unit that was assigned to take a position. It's from the Songchan Valley, August 25. It starts with a quote. "I'm sorry, sir, but my men refuse to go. We cannot move out," Lieutenant Eugene Schertz, Jr. reported to his battalion commander over a crackling field telephone. Company A of the 196th Light Infantry Brigade's battle-worn 3rd Battalion had been ordered at dawn yesterday to move once more down the jungle rocky slopes of Nu Leon Mountain into a labyrinth of North Vietnamese bunkers and trench lines 31 miles south of Da Nang. For 5 days, the company had obeyed orders to make this push. Each time it had been thrown back by invisible enemy forces which waited through bombs and artillery shells for the Americans to come close. Then it picked them off. The battalion commander, Lieutenant Colonel Robert C. Bacon, had been waiting impatiently for Company A to move out. Colonel Bacon had taken over the battalion after Lieutenant Colonel Ali P. Howard was killed in a helicopter crash with 7 others. Since the crash Tuesday, the battalion has been trying to get to the wreckage. Yesterday morning, Colonel Bacon was leading 3 of his companies in the assault. He paled as Lieutenant Schertz told him that the soldiers of Company A would not follow orders. "Repeat that, please," the colonel said, without raising his voice. "Have you told them what it means to disobey orders under fire?" "I think they understand," the lieutenant replied, "but some of them simply have had enough. They're broken. There are boys here who have only 90 days left in Vietnam. They want to go home in one piece. The situation is psychic here." "Are you talking about the enlisted men or the NCOs? Are they involved?" the colonel asked. "That's the difficulty here," Lieutenant Schertz said. "We've got a leadership problem. Most of our squad and platoon leaders have been killed or wounded." At one point in the fight, Company A was down to 60 men, half of its assigned combat strength. The colonel told Lieutenant Schertz, "Go to talk to them again and tell them that to the best of our knowledge, the bunkers are now empty. The enemy is withdrawn. The mission of A Company today is to recover the dead. They have no reason to be afraid. Please take a hand count of how many do not want to go." The lieutenant came back a few minutes later. "They won't go, Colonel, and I didn't ask for the hand count because I'm afraid that they all stick together, even though some might prefer to go." The colonel told him, "Leave those men on the hill and take your CP element and move to the objective." The lieutenant said he was preparing to move his command post and asked, "What do we do with the ammunition supplies? Shall we destroy them?" "Leave it with the others," the colonel ordered. Then Colonel Bacon told his executive officer, Major Richard Waite, and one of his Vietnam veterans, Sergeant Oki Blankenship, to fly from the battalion base across the valley to talk with Company A. "Give them a pep talk and a kick in the butt," he said. They found the men exhausted in the tall, blackened elephant grass, their uniforms ripped and caked with dirt. The soldiers said one of them was crying, Sergeant Blankenship said. The soldiers told why they would not move. "It poured out of them," the sergeant said. They said they were sick of the endless battling and torrid heat, the constant danger of sudden firefights by day, the mortar fire and enemy probing at night. They said that they had not had enough sleep and that they were being pushed too hard. They had not had any mail or hot food. They had not had any of the little comforts that made the war endurable. Helicopters brought in those basic needs, ammunition, food, and water, at a tremendous risk under heavy enemy ground fire, but the men believed that they were in danger of annihilation and would go no further. Major Waite and Sergeant Blankenship listened to the soldiers, most of them a generation younger, draftees 19 and 20 years old. Sergeant Blankenship, a quick-tempered man, began arguing. "One of them yelled to me that his company had suffered too much and that it should not have to go on," Sergeant Blankenship said. "I answered him that another company was down to 15 men still on the move. I'd lied to him. And he asked me, why did they do it?" "Maybe they've got something a little more than what you've got," the sergeant told him. "Don't call us cowards. We are not cowards," the soldier howled, running towards Sergeant Blankenship, fists up. Sergeant Blankenship turned and walked down the ridge line to the company commander. The sergeant looked back and saw that the men of Company A were stirring. They picked up their rifles, fell into a loose formation, and followed him down the cratered slope. Thank you.
David Halberstam is the well-known author of The Making of a Quagmire. He also had a reply to General Seidel.
I listened to General Seidel last night, and I don't want to go into a mini debate here, our panel connected to his, but hearing him say that there had been too many short-term reporters there, when the DOD, in fact, was constantly flying in reporters from hometowns because they were more malleable material than the resident correspondents like Peter Arnett, hearing him say that Time and Newsweek wrote
softer in Saigon and had it made tougher in New York, which is a canard of the first order. I brought Frank McCullough of Time Magazine's phone number with me tonight. It's 916-446-9576. He can call and check it out, write a note of appendage to the conference, and above all, challenging reporters on the verification of stories when, in fact, the most constant use of misinformation and the lack of verification went on day after day in the 5 o'clock follies, where reports from Vietnamese officers never substantiated or witnessed by American officers would be passed on, and through the transmutation of that briefing sponsored by MACV would thereupon come out as American sources said, so that each day there would be a positive story coming out of the briefing, that someone like Joe Freed could sit there and tear the flesh off an American briefing officer and harass him and beat him up, and then go back and write the story that he was programmed to write about how we had once again defeated the Viet Cong or the NVA, thus negating the story that Peter Arnett or Horst Voss would be doing that day, and certainly neutralizing it. Hearing that left me with a melancholy feeling that the debate, 10 years later, had not progressed, and that we should, looking not just at the reporters in Vietnam, but based upon all the material published, have some far greater context to see that which they did and why it caused so much contention and pain. Because it was an extension, finally, of a policy. We know a good deal more about that policy now, about the fact that the policy was conceived in lies, fear, not the fear of losing Vietnamese to communism, but the fear that if that happened, they would lose Washington to the Republicans. Misconceptions of the other side, an unwillingness to understand what the French Indochina War had done to nationalism. We had a highest political officer, the Secretary of State, who still believed that there was no split between the Chinese and the Russians. We had a president who systematically was upping the ante without admitting that he was, going to war in James Reston's phrase, by stealth, slipping it in, more and more slicing the salami while never admitting it, saying it was a small war while going on to a big war. We had the highest level of officers in the country, in the Defense Department, Secretary of Defense, who was a liar. I will give you only one small example of his lying. There are many, but it would take up the panel's work to detail the lies of the poet laureate of the Ford Motor Company. But in the fall of 1965, he visited with General Westmoreland, and he found out from General Westmoreland that the hopes, the 200,000 troops, which was a much larger number than anybody had ever believed, that would do it, would not work. And Westy told him that it was going to be a big war, minimum 400,000 and possibly 5 and maybe even 6. And so he went back to tell his forces to gear up that it was going to be a big war. At exactly the same time, the Council of Economic Advisors, who do the budgeting for the country, came by, and they went to see Mr. McNamara, who had just told the Pentagon to gear up for 500,000 people. And they said, is it a big war or a small war? And he said to the men who set the budget of the United States of America, small war. He did not just lie to the people of the United States and the Congress of the United States. He lied to his own budget officers, out of which has come the inflation that is still with us. No wonder, then, that we, who were the reporters in Vietnam, came under such criticism, and found ourselves again and again challenging the alleged norms being set by Washington. And that's what, of course, made us controversial. Were we going to be loyal first and foremost to the ideal of an American democracy, or were we automatically, in the immortal words of so many high officials, going to get on the team?
Robert Scheer is a reporter for the Los Angeles Times. He proposes a more critical view of the quality of reporting from Vietnam.
Well, I just wanted to add one item to Barry's list. Beware of this and beware of that. And to quote General Eisenhower, beware of the wrong war in the wrong time in the wrong place, which is something we've left out of the whole discussion here. I mean, this is sort of a primer of how to do it again without questioning whether it should be done. I think the problem that we've had in focusing on this question illustrates what's wrong with media coverage of this kind of situation. It's one, ahistorical. The assumption here is that the war began when this group of correspondents went to Vietnam, or when television got interested, or when U.S. troops went to Vietnam. The idea that there had been thousands of years of history of that country, that the Chinese had occupied it for 1,000 years, the French for 80 years, the Japanese, what have you, long struggle against these different governments and so forth, is not even mentioned. And the assumption that somehow all of history begins when it's important to our ambitions, our goals, our interests, is rather perverse, I think. Secondly, the part of history that's taken seriously is the war game, the shooting, the firing, the stuff that works on television, rather than any more underlying serious factors that might have caused all this to happen, which brings me to my third source of error in media coverage of this sort of situation, and that's a very limited ability to question the big assumptions, the geopolitical assumptions of the government that represents you. I think that was characteristic of this coverage. So much of the reporting, even when it was gutsy and bold about, you know, the lies of the government, the incorrect statistics and so forth, accepted the basic assumptions that the war had to be won, that the war was virtuous, and the criticism was very much of the quiet American school of criticism. You remember Graham Greene's novel? The Steve Canyon type. You always wanted General Lansdale or Steve Canyon to return. So instead of No Dinh Diem, you would have had some proud American paratrooper running the show who could win the minds and hearts of the people. And I think that reporting continued to the very end. I think that it goes then finally to a basic question of the political attitudes of media people. Since this is a journalism conference, let me and by mentioning something about that. I, for the longest time, have believed that the best journalists are Trotskyists. the reason being, and this is true even when they become neoconservatives, because if you look at the neoconservatives, they're mostly ex-Trotskyists also. The reason being that these are profoundly political people who want to deal with big ideas, want to deal with history, want to do library research, want to think about major questions in provocative ways, and being Trotskyists, there's never a government in the world that they have to apologize for. And at the risk of being quoted when I go to work tomorrow as saying all journalists should become Trotskyists or something, I would commend that as a stance. I don't think it's enough to do the cops and robbers reporting, the police beat reporting. I think when you're talking about international events, you're talking about intervention in another country's history, you have to get historical. You have to read up on it. You have to care about it. You have to be sensitive to its complexity, as was said before. But you also have to get involved with the big political, economic questions that are supposed to be behind it. And to my mind, the war in Vietnam could never have been sustained for 24 hours if this country had really focused on the basic assumptions for that war, because the assumptions had evaporated by the time we committed 500,000 American troops.
This is California Public Radio.